This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Barack Obama's speech in Philadelphia this week was not resolved everybody's questions about his former pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr. Openly and otherwise, it's likely to be a factor in the nomination fight, and if Senator Obama wins that, in the general election as well. But whatever the political effect may be, the speech also challenged us to talk about race. So today we want to explore exactly how we do that. Is race something you talk about at home? At work? Do we speak differently depending on who we're talking to? Do we ignore or gloss over a set of issues that many find uncomfortable? Is race just a black and white issue? Do we talk about race when an opportunity arises? The OJ trial, Katrina, Barry Bonds, and yes, the Reverend Wright. Or is this an ongoing discussion? Does the conversation generate resentment and anger, or do we deflect the heat with humor? Many commentators have written interesting takes this week. We've invited four of them to speak with us today, and we need to hear from you. How do you talk about race? Call and tell us your story. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Erin Aubrey Kaplan is a contributing editor to the opinion section of the Los Angeles Times. She joins us today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me on, Neil.
And in your most recent op-ed, you said you're angry. What are you mad about?
Oh, so many things. I just wanted to make the point that black people, at least most of the ones that I know, are mad in one form or another. That doesn't mean that they go around looking angry. But all of us, so many of us, are just distressed about the conditions in Black America. I could give you a list, but maybe I'll do that later. Mm-hmm. But, you know, public education, unemployment. I'll just throw out one statistic that has become sort of normal, and that is the unemployment rate of Black males, I believe, in Milwaukee is close to 50%. That's just not a good thing for all of us. And we see these things, and even though things have gotten better, we all know that, they are so far from being good. And so, you know, we are at the very least aggravated, distressed, if not actually angry about all these things. And it's a kind of a constant state of mind.
And is this an anger that Blacks can express amongst themselves, but more difficult to express it across ethnic lines?
Oh, absolutely. We really do have a lot, you know, different conversations going on. We talk about this amongst ourselves all the time. But I do not generally had these conversations with, say, white people, because there's really no history of it. And we kind of assume that other people don't want to hear it, because we get that message all the time. People think it's complaining. They think it's it makes them uncomfortable. If we did bring it up, we always feel like we're in a position of explaining ourselves and our points of view to people who don't understand it or don't want to hear it. So we tend just not to put it out there.
So it comes up what some might regard as a teachable moment. And somebody might say, well, what do you think about Reverend Wright and Senator Obama? Right. And you feel like you have to explain.
Absolutely. And that's frankly a little tiring. I'm happy to be on the program. Very often we only have these conversations when something like this, quote unquote, happens. But my point just was that this is, to me, is not something that happens. This is not a moment. This is actually a general state of mind.
A condition.
Yeah, exactly.
Simmering resentment. Is that fair to say?
Sure. Simmering. But again, you know, we also don't want to give this image to the rest of the country that all Black people are walking around with these huge chips on their shoulders and, you know, ready to blow at any moment. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a stereotype. And so in a way, you know, the anger really is historical. It's longstanding. And we have just learned how to cope with it, I suppose. Channel it into, you know, constructive ways, or just kind of set it aside and express it amongst each other, you know, go to church, you know, give back to the community, all those kinds of things. Again, you know, anger and dissatisfaction are for us, you know, entirely logical. And frankly, I don't think enough Black people are angry enough.
Interesting. In his speech, Senator Obama was talking about some of the attitudes of older African Americans, mm-hmm. like the Reverend Wright, mm-hmm. which he said were a little bit, you know, past it. You're a younger woman, certainly a lot younger than me. do you see a difference generationally?
Well, actually, you know, I am exactly Barack Obama's age. We were born the same year. And I'm not as angry as my father. Okay, he is still pretty very dissatisfied with the way things are, and I am also dissatisfied. I live in a different political era than my dad, but I very much see things that are wrong, even though I, you know, personally am doing okay. That actually makes my anger all the more logical, because I look around and see opportunities that I had that I feel are already closed off or you know, have gotten less. So I'm just angry in a different way, I think. But I have never, there's never been a point where I've said, you know, okay, I can rest. You know, this, you know, we can stop feeling this way. I just don't think that's true yet.
Let's get some callers in on this conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We're talking with Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, a contributing editor to the opinion page section of the Los Angeles Times. And let's go to Roy, and Roy's calling us from Cincinnati in Ohio.
Hello.
Hi, Roy.
First, thank you for having me on, and especially thank you for having this topic. It's been a long time since there's been an open discussion about race where people are interested in absorbing information instead of just yelling and screaming.
We may get to that later,
right.
But
what I wanted to bring out was I am biracial. My mother's white, my father's black, and I was raised by my white mother. Went in a black neighborhood, and a whole complicated, convoluted situation with that. And I really talk about race very often. I talk about it at work. I talk about it in my home life because it's very important to me. It was made very important to me by society that I was raised in. Now, I have found in my experience that it is that even though I am biracial, it's quite obvious that white people will still look at me as being black. I have other features than just my skin tone that make some people think that.
Mm-hmm.
And but I've found that they will be more prone to talk in a more intellectual way where they're dispassionate, whereas the black people, which I'm related to as well, will be much more, you know, relational, much more sympathetic, and you'll be able to talk more about the things that have happened. It's clear to me that there's been a big divide in that view as for impact as well, because blacks will, even if you deny it, eventually you will realize there is racism affecting you, whereas the white people in my family and white people that I've known, they actually believe that racism is gone.
And do you find that they or you approach this subject on eggshells?
I know that when the Cincinnati riots happened back in 2001, on the next day, I went out into the streets because I knew people had to talk about race. I went down to the center of the city and approached two strange middle-aged white guys to me and just started talking with them. And they were very hesitant, and they were very removed and distant. They were shocked that I had approached them, and in fact, there was a lot of that. But in the same vein, I was part of a group that gathered a bunch of liberal-minded Jews that were willing to talk about it, but they also had this limit that they wouldn't talk anymore about, where, you know, once I started talking too much about it, it was no longer in their interest. But of course, when I was talking with black people in the same situation that I was, we could talk for months.
Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, you have a foot in two camps, too.
I do.
Yeah. And do you find that Roy's experience mirrors your own?
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. My foot in two camps?
Yes. Your husband is white?
Yeah.
And that, doesn't that give you some opportunity to talk to his family, too?
Well, you know, of course it does. Although I have to say, we live in a mostly black neighborhood. So that's interesting, you know, in one sense. But, you know, I think Roy brings up a very good point. This has to do with context. You know, it depends on who you're talking to. Even if you're talking to whites who are, you know, you have to kind of feel them out. Are they sympathetic or not? You know, how far can you go? Do you even bring it up? We're constantly having to make those decisions. And even if they are sympathetic, and even if it's your own family, because, yes, I do have this issue. You know, my family is you know, my in-laws are white. I tend to talk more theoretically about race as opposed to my experiences. That I talk about with, you know, my black family and friends. So very often there's not that connection you make, that you make as, you know, a black person to connect your experience with, you know, something more analytical. I find myself making those adjustments almost subconsciously. I'm not sure that's a good thing.
Hmm.
Well, do that.
I could add real quick to that. It's my belief is the reason why they would rather talk about it intellectually mm-hmm. because it's not an effect they feel. It's
right.
something that they see.
Not part of
they
their experience.
They aren't removed from it.
Yeah.
Right. Right. You're absolutely right. And I think that that contributes to, you know, people being shocked, like in this instance with, you know, with Pastor Wright being shocked to, quote unquote, hear these things, hear this kind of feeling, because they simply don't, they don't hear it and they don't see it and they don't experience it. When we talk about inequality, if you're not experiencing the inequality and you're on the other side, where things work for you, or the government works for you, or you're okay, you're going to be very surprised to hear this. It's almost like it's a world you don't see, or that, you know, you don't touch.
Roy, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome. I wanted to add one more thing, is that actually I do get to see both sides in the situation that I'm in, because mm-hmm. I will hear one side say how ridiculous the other side is being, no matter which side it was.
Okay.
Yeah, I get that, too.
Thanks very much, Roy. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Let's talk, see if we can get Jan in. Jan is calling us from Las Vegas in Nevada.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I'm calling because I was raised in Texas and in a white family, and my mother grew up hearing terrible racial epithets. Sometimes I still hear them, and I'm embarrassed to hear them. But she has become a Barack Obama fan, and so I'm very thrilled to see that happen.
Hmm.
But even I, at this level of my life, I'm almost 60, I'm still learning my African-American friends of little ways that we hurt other people, just little assumptions you make. And, you know, I have a very young African-American friend, and very dearly, to, you know, let me know that I said things that hurt her. So I just hope, I have great hope.
Well, that's great.
That's great, Jen. Thanks very much.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And Erin Aubrey Kaplan, we'd like to thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you, Neil.
Erin Aubrey Kaplan, nice to have you with us. She's a contributing editor to Opinion of the section of the Los Angeles Times and joined us today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. This week in particular, the country is talking about race, so are we. Coming up, we'll hear one view of how many white people think about race and why they don't talk about it. We want to hear your stories this hour. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This week, the country is talking about race, and we're talking about how we talk about race. Do we really need to hear from you on this? Do you talk about race differently at the kitchen table than you do at the water cooler? How does the conversation change depending on who you're talking to? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Sarah. Sarah's with us from Folsom in Washington.
Folsom, California.
California, all right.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My sister's first husband is black, and I was very young at the time that she married him, and he opened my eyes to things like the experience of driving while black and, you know, the extent to which I'm very privileged. What I find as a result of that experience is that people will be talking to me and they think that they're confiding certain things about race or religion, and I feel the obligation to expose them on those things.
Call them on it.
Call them on it?
Yeah, I mean to say that's wrong.
Yes, which is always a really uncomfortable thing to do, but I don't do it because I get some kind of high out of it. It's because I feel that if it goes on without any comment, then I've tacitly agreed to it.
You're sort of an unindicted co-conspirator.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I've tacitly agreed to remarks. And I also happen to be Jewish, and people don't think I look Jewish, and they will confide certain things in me. And so I set them right.
And how do these conversations go? I mean, do you say, you know, hey, wait a minute, that's wrong? Or do you get angry? Do you try a joke, maybe?
I find that there's not an easy way to do it, but in general, it's not a good idea to anger the person, because then they won't be able to hear what I'm saying. But I will question them on it. I will question their assumptions.
Hmm. And do you think this is something important for you to do for yourself? Nevertheless, have you lost friends over it?
No, I haven't lost friends over it, but I do think it's important to do. I also think it's important to do, because I am still, being white in this country, I am privileged, and being female, I can tell you I don't get hassled at the airport to the extent that I've seen other people in the past. I think that if I don't confront these things, and I continue to live a life that's very isolated from black and minority people, I see insensitivity creeping into my own worldview.
Sarah, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Joining us now is Robert Jensen. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, the author of The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege. And he's with us today from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Great to be with you, Neil.
And I wonder, as a white man, I know you've written about how difficult it is sometimes to have conversations about race with other white people, in fact, with anybody.
Well, it's difficult in some sense, but of course it's easy, because in the dominant position, one can take on these questions quite easily. What I've found is it's actually much easier in some sense for me to talk about white supremacy than for some of my black colleagues and black friends, because they are going to be labeled as whiny and angry, and I can do it and push the envelope further. So in one sense, of course, many white people, for emotional reasons, are fearful. But we also have a kind of latitude to speak more bluntly and more honestly, and I think we should take it.
Well, when you use expressions like white supremacy, I assume you get a rise out of some white people.
Yeah, because I think we have to recognize that white supremacy is the dominant ideology of the culture. And here I'm not talking about Klan members and neo-Nazis, the overt white supremacists, but to recognize that we still live in a white supremacist society, that in ideological terms, the way the knowledge of this culture is structured. Open the course catalog of the University of Texas at Austin, where I teach, and you'll see white points of view reflected predominantly. And of course, in material terms, this is still a white supremacist society. There is still a racialized gap between white and non-white society. That's a white supremacist society. We're the most affluent country in the history of the world, the most powerful country in the history of the world. If we wanted to erase the racialized gaps in wealth and well-being that exist, we could do it. We simply choose not to. I think it's fair to call the United States a white supremacist society.
And you also talk about the origins of the fears of white people, including a fear, getting back to what you were just saying, of losing what we, white people, have.
Right. I think there's a lot of fears that work within us who are white. One, as you point out, is that we realize at some level that some of the material goods we get in this culture as white folks are connected to that racialized disparity. So there's the fear of losing actual things. There's the fear of losing status. There's the fear of those kinds of very tangible outcomes if it was a more racially just society. But there's other fears working for white folks. I think at some level, white people know that some of what we have has nothing to do with our own hard work, our own brilliance. It has to do with living in that position of privilege, and we're afraid to confront that. The other thing I've noticed, and this was a very painful process of coming to terms with it in myself, is that white people, especially us good liberal white folks, those of us who are supposed to get it, also carry around within us, of course, a lot of racist training. And I think a lot of white people, again, especially liberal white folks, are afraid that somehow that racist training is just going to emerge, and especially people of color are going to see it and they're going to mark it. So I think part of the hesitancy to talk about race on the part of white people is a fear of stepping out into this what seems like very dangerous territory on the possibility that people of color might see you, or more appropriately, perhaps see through us and recognize the lingering effects of that racist training. But again, we have enormous privilege in this culture as white people, and we have an obligation, as other callers and guests have said, to step out and mark the nature of a white supremacist society and to work against it.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Kim, and Kim's calling from Goshen, Indiana.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Oh, I absolutely agree. It doesn't sound at all shocking to me when he talks about this being a white supremacist nation. My daughter, my 12-year-old daughter, is of mixed race, and my parents are very racist. My mom will say things in front of my daughter, like she's worried about Sasha never getting a boyfriend because the boy's parents will never accept her because of her race.
In front of her?
Yes, in front of her. And my mother refers to my daughter's black family that lives in North Carolina. She refers to them as those colored people. And when she says that, my daughter will say, Grandma, why do you call them that? And I say, Mom, you really must watch it. You know that's not right.
There must have been a moment, I don't know if you heard the senator's speech, but when he was talking about the inability to disown his own grandmother, must have been striking quite close to home.
I know. That's the reason why I called. When I heard you say that, I thought, oh, my gosh, I've got to tell Neil. My mom does the exact same thing to my 12-year-old daughter. So I absolutely understand where Senator Obama is coming from in that. And I'm sorry he had to deal with it, and I'm sorry my daughter has to deal with it.
Yeah, we are too. Nevertheless, is this a subject you can talk to with your mother, apparently not productively?
That's right. I can talk to her until I'm blue in the face. My parents are both this way. Yeah, they are absolutely steadfast in their feeling that they don't see anything wrong with the way they think or the way they believe.
And some people might say, you know, why do you take your daughter there anymore if she's going to be subject to what a lot of people would regard as abuse?
Well, yes, but we are blood. And while I am trying to correct Mom and Dad in the way they think, and, you know, there's no getting around it, in my relationship with my daughter, teach her that the way Grandma and Grandpa feel is wrong. And she knows that, as she sees, she is the only mixed-race child in our family, and, you know, we are all white with blue eyes, and my lovely daughter has tan skin with very dark eyes, and she knows there's a difference. Of course, she's 12 years old. And sometimes she refers to that. She refers to, she wishes that she was white. She doesn't like to go out in the sun because her lovely skin gets darker. And she just sometimes feels badly about that. And I tell her that the problem that she's going to have in her life probably will have people take advantage of her beauty rather than worrying about that she's mixed race.
I suspect, let's hope that's true. Let's hope that's true. Thanks very much for the call, Kim.
You're welcome.
And we wish you and your daughter the best of luck.
Thank you.
And I wonder, Robert Jensen, you were talking about fears earlier and confronting them just hearing that phone call. There was an incident you described in your essay, an incident that came in at, I guess, another one of those teachable moments. This was about the OJ trial, and you found yourself on a panel sitting next to a black man.
Yeah, it's one of those times when I had to confront my own fears. So there I was, the expert, the white guy supposed to know things about this. And I realized that in public I was afraid that my colleague sitting next to me, a very good scholar and a very decent human being, was going to somehow see through me, see that I hadn't fully dealt with my own racist training. And I did get that very intense racist training that's so common in this country. And it was confronting that fear that helped me. And that was maybe a decade ago. Of course, if you're honest as a white person, you face these things all the time. It's a constant learning experience. And I think the only thing that I can testify to is that if one does that, one not only becomes a better person in some sort of moral or political sense, but life gets a lot better. When you shed fears, you move through the world in a much more productive and satisfying way. So for those of us who are white, I think there's both an argument from justice, in a sense, that we should be confronting white supremacy and racism because it's the right thing to do. But I also think we have to talk honestly about what I suppose we could call an argument from self-interest, that our own lives become richer and more meaningful when we have the courage to confront these things. And these things come up every day. I just came from class where a similar kind of incident reminded me, much less traumatic perhaps, of how important it is to just speak honestly in public about these things.
What was the incident?
Well, I was announcing an event coming up by a speaker with a Hispanic name, and I stumbled over it. And I instead of, you know, sort of retreating from it, I made the point quite obviously that those of us who grew up in predominantly Anglo areas often have trouble with other names. And instead of avoiding it, we should confront it. And in this case, I asked for help from people in the class who were more familiar with it. And it was a very positive moment, I think.
Robert Jensen, thanks very much for your time today.
Great to be with you.
Robert Jensen, a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, the author of The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege. He joined us today from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. If you'd like to join this conversation, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can check out what other listeners are writing about on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. And joining us now, not everybody thought Senator Obama's speech started a good dialogue. Michael Myers is executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. His op-ed called Obama Blew It appeared in today's Los Angeles Times, and he joins us today from NPR's Bureau in New York. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
And Senator Obama addressed how race is affecting his campaign. In your op-ed, you say he blew it and explained racial differences, amplified deep-seated racial tensions. Should we not address race at this point?
Well, I think we have to address race and talk about race differently. And that was the uniqueness of the Obama candidacy up until the point of his speech on race, in that, you know, this notion of mixed races, that's racial idiocy. We all belong to the same race. That's the human race. And the civil rights community in particular understands that we believe in absolute equality and that race ain't what it used to be. And we fight all the time against stereotypes and groupthink and putting people in racial boxes. And our effort has been to remove narrow constrictions of the mind, to extirpate prejudice, to broaden one's horizons so that we are fighting stereotypes based on race, on gender, sexual orientation, and we must begin in our language to treat people as individuals and to regard them as individuals and to judge them as individuals and based on, as Dr. King used to say, the content of their character, not their skin color. So, you know, when Obama started talking about groups such as whites who resent affirmative action and forgetting that there are plenty of whites who support affirmative action and that support for affirmative action is not a racial test. Or opposition to affirmative action is not a racial test. You have people of all colors on both sides of that very vexing public policy question. So, you know, and this is to acknowledge, obviously, that there is a legacy and a culture of racist thinking, racialist thinking. But it comes out in many different forms. Paternalism, outright discrimination, racial nonsense, prejudice, stereotyping, tokenism, glass ceilings. And therefore, I believe that when we have to have one standard, and so when ministers such as the Reverend Jeremiah Wright talks racial nonsense and speaks as a bigot, then we have to condemn that as bigotry. When Louis Farrakhan speaks as a bigot, we must condemn it as bigotry. And I don't want to hear nonsense, that's what it is, about one has to have a trained ear. My ear is trained. My ear is focused. It is black, but it doesn't mean anything that you have a white ear or a black ear or a yellow ear or a brown ear. You recognize bigotry for what it is.
In your piece, in fact, you said that reference to the untrained ear, meaning whites and Asians and Latinos, don't understand.
Well, that's what the implication is.
Yes.
I think there are people who understand bigotry. And my point is that I believe that we should have one nation that is united, not around racial fiefdoms and tribalism, ethnic polarization, ethnic chauvinism, or whether or not one is married black and white and whether or not you're a hybrid. All that is racial nonsense. All that is old hat. All that is dysfunctional thinking. All that is group think, which must be fought against. And Obama was the transformational candidate who wanted to be judged based on his qualifications, based on his character, based on his philosophies, based on his policies, based on his notion of change. And change means getting away from the notion that we can judge people and group people and think about people and talk about people based on these categories. And that was the mistake of Geraldine Ferraro. That was the mistake of Governor Rendell, who said that, you know, people are not going to vote for Obama between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia because he sees Archie Bunkers out there. Well, as a leader, he has to fight those notions of racism. And he shouldn't deify them. He shouldn't reinforce them. He has to fight them. And he has to, as a leader, say, you cannot judge a person on the basis of their skin color or, for that matter, their gender. What is wrong with that?
Mike Myers, stay with us, if you will, and we're going to continue this conversation when we come back. We'll talk more about how we discuss race at the kitchen table, at the office, with our families, and including a conversation with Gustavo Arellano on the role that humor can play in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're taking a moment to examine what we talk about when we talk about race with our families, with people of different backgrounds, and how that conversation changes from place to place, group to group, person to person. How do you talk about race? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Our guest is Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, who wrote an op-ed entitled Obama Blew It, which appeared in the Los Angeles Times. He's with us from our bureau in New York. Let's get a caller on the line. And this is Julie. Julie's with us from Reno in Nevada.
Hello.
Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I have a question about how do we begin to talk about race in the classroom. I find my students, when I ask about race and where they see it, to all be very open and not to admit that we have race problems in society.
Do you have any advice for her, Michael Myers?
Oh, yes. The New York Civil Rights Coalition runs a program in the schools. It's called the Unlearning Stereotypes, a Civil Rights and Race Relations Program. And what we do is we send volunteer lawyers and law students. We team them up, usually biracially, and male and female as a team. Two people go into a classroom at the same time. That way they present role models of adults who are successful, who work together across racial and gender lines. Just symbolically, the students get it. And they bring up issues of current events, and they talk about and have the students talk about and examine all kinds of stereotypes, stereotypes based on race, based on gender, based on sexual orientation. And what we have learned and found that students not only get it, but this generation is different from past generations in that they really believe that race ain't what it used to be, and they are mixing it up. Their friends are black, white, Asian, Native American, Hispanic. They date across, quote unquote, skin colors and races, and genders. And what we have also found out is that people are hopeful. They're not angry. They are not dispirited. And we have to give young people in particular opportunities for learning and overcoming discrimination and prejudice. And when they get to talk about these issues, not in a paternalistic fashion, but in a candid fashion, in a way that they're entitled to their opinions as individuals. They don't represent, and they are not surrogates for group grievance. They talk about these issues as individuals. And that's what I'm urging people to do, that we must use the power of the human intellect to stop this gibberish about skin color differences.
Julie, does that description describe your students? First of all, how old are they?
They're freshmen in college, and it does. It seems like they've been taught that they shouldn't be racist, so that when you ask them questions about where you see race, that they don't want to admit that there's a problem. And they do seem reluctant to bring up, you know, individual cases. And they are dating, you know, interracially and have friends of other races.
Do you worry that they're blinkered and ignoring things that are important? Or are you hopeful that they're maybe, as Michael Myers was saying, a new generation that has new attitudes?
Well, I'm hopeful that they are open to other races, but I do think that sometimes perhaps they're ignoring issues of race because they don't necessarily see it within their community or environment or friendships.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look at the college communities in particular, and I was talking about high schools with respect to Unlearning Stereotypes program. But in high schools in particular, you find that the colleges and the universities reinforce notions of cultural difference and race, and they bring black students, for example, to colleges and campuses long before they bring the white students because they think that minority students aren't yet up to a rigorous college environment. And then when they bring the minority students ahead of the rest of the class, they get to know each other by race, and they get to know all the culture of the campus, about how this campus is supposedly white racist. Therefore, we have to room together. We got to have a black dormitory. This reinforces racial patterns. And we don't empower people to act as individuals because we deprive them of their individuality. The colleges and universities are supposed to be the best and the brightest of minds. All they do is reinforce and perpetuate racial idiocy and stereotypes.
Julie, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Michael Myers, we appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you.
Michael Myers, anytime. Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. His op-ed, Obama Blew It, appeared in today's editions of the Los Angeles Times, and he joined us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Mike. Mike with us from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi. Yes, hi. This is Mike.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm an Asian American, and I want to talk about a little bit about sort of the race conversation in amongst my Asian friends. I think there's a diversity of sort of the topics and the view about race. I mean, some of us will get really excited when we say, for example, watching American Idols or America's Best Dance Crew, when you see Asian person. Asian contestants, you know, you get very excited. I think in many ways it's sort of like, well, we wonder if people can really understand sort of our Asian experience. Some of my friends who do try to blend into sort of the mainstream America and try to feel like, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't be thinking about race a whole lot. And so there's sort of a diversity of sort of opinion. But at the same time, I think one major issue is really about solidarity and how much are we willing to sort of be willing to listen to one another's experiences. I mean, I remember one. I have two really good friends from North Carolina, and they're Caucasian. But when I first met them, they really were genuinely and say, you know, would you tell me about your Asian American experience? You know, because we had no idea what's it like when you were growing up, and that was a very refreshing sort of a conversation. And that gives sort of opportunity for this kind of conversation.
I wonder, when Americans do talk about race on those occasions, do you feel that they're talking just about blacks and whites and not so much about Asians and Hispanics?
Oh, yeah, especially for Asian. I think even for Asian, the term of perpetual foreigners continue to come up for us. I remember multiple times in either business functions or social functions when I meet Caucasian people, and they will immediately say, "Oh, you know, I've been to China," or or something like that. And I said, "Well, you know, I've never been to China before. You know, I grew up in the U.S. and or they will make certain assumptions. And I think that largely is a result of the fact that people aren't comfortable talking about race issues, aren't comfortable to talk about cultural issues. So when they do get into those situations, they don't really know how to start. And you know, it makes the conversation very awkward.
Yes, indeed. Mike, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Joining us now is Gustavo Arellano. He's the writer of the Ask a Mexican column for the Orange County Weekly and author of the book Ask a Mexican. And he joins us today from member station KPCC in Pasadena, California. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Hola, Neil.
And I know that your column takes some people might take as offensive or insulting questions and responds to, at least to begin with humor. Do you find that an effective approach?
It's been very effective. I've been doing the column now for about 3 years, and many people email me and love the fact that I do use satire to debunk so many stereotypes that people have, in my case specifically about Mexicans, not Latinos, specifically Mexicans, not other groups and so forth. And I have found it effective because when it comes to stereotypes, here in the United States, we have such a rich, I say sarcastically, tradition of stereotyping the other, stereotyping minorities, and the best way to fight them, I could weep and moan about them, or I could poke fun at the idiots who are perpetuating those stereotypes at me.
Yeah, but nevertheless, is humor effective, do you think?
Absolutely. I could tell you anecdotes where people say, hey, because of the humor that you use, now I could go back at people, and when they criticize me or try to stereotype me, I could just hit them back with the debunking that you show them to be. I don't have empirical evidence that could say that, but just from my experience, it's been much more effective than me writing a serious op-ed piece, because I also do write op-ed pieces where I'm a little bit more serious, but I've found that my pieces for Ask a Mexican are much more powerful and get much more of a reaction, a positive reaction, than anything serious I could possibly hope to write.
And just going back to that conversation we had with Mike, the caller from Boston a moment ago, is this conversation, when America does talk about race, sometimes go right past Hispanics and Asians and other people just to focus on African Americans and Caucasians.
I think that's how it's historically been, but really in the past 10 to 15 years, when illegal immigration has been such a hot topic in this country, now you have the conversation or the topic of Hispanics, or specifically Mexicans, going into the dialogue about race. And down in the Southwest United States, of course, that dialogue has been going on since the United States won the Mexican-American War back in 1848.
I was going to say 1493, but anyway.
No, in that case, I'll go back to the Spanish Armada. We could go. Actually, my theory is the reason why Mexicans will always remain a perpetual other is because, as I think he's a sociologist or historian, Samuel Huntington over at Harvard, he once wrote this very controversial essay where he says Mexicans are incompatible with American culture, but he broke it down very specifically. Mexicans are Hispanic, they speak Spanish, and they're Roman Catholic. Americans, whatever that may mean, they're English, they speak English, and they're Protestant. And I think there is some credence to that theory.
We're talking with Gustavo Arellano, who writes the column Ask a Mexican. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wonder, there's now been so much. We were talking earlier in the show about resentment and anger, which certainly comes up in this issue. And the immigration issue has heated up so much. People almost go off immediately. Is it easy to talk with your white friends, with your white colleagues about this issue?
It's really hard, because if there are a lot of good people out there who do have who are opposed to illegal immigration, and I do believe that a lot of them, they're not racist, they're not bigots, but it's so hard to have that conversation, because almost immediately whenever it comes to that topic, they'll say, oh, those illegal immigrants, they're not learning English, they're keeping their culture. And those are not arguments about illegal immigration. Those are topics about immigration, and those are the same things that were thrown against the Irish and the Italians a century ago when they were coming here the legal way. My all-time favorite column that I ever wrote was somebody asked, why don't Mexicans ever bother to learn English? And then I said that the United States government shares their concern. They came out with this study that showed this new wave of immigrants, they don't speak the language, they only make money to send back. Well, the thing with that study, it was a 1911 Dillingham Commission report, and the immigrants that they were attacking at the time were Italians, Eastern Europeans, and Jews.
And given, well, again, bringing up the absurdity is another form of humor, I guess. And do you find, you write this column, which you can obviously, think about. Do you find that you do that in regular life, too, that you can use a joke to deflect people's anger?
I'll give you the best anecdote I know, which happened to myself. One time I was at this really fancy I would call it a supper club in Orange County, and it was Mexican buffet night. So I was going, I was going to get myself some beans and rice, and I was dressed in what some people call a waiter shirt, a guayabera, which is a fancy shirt that Mexicans use whenever it's the summertime. So I'm serving myself beans and rice, and a older white lady comes up to me and says, "Oh, can I get served as well?" And my response to her was like, "Oh no, ma'am, I'm not the waiter. It's a misunderstanding." Well, I meet her about an hour later. I'm waiting for my car at the valet, and she gives me the keys to her car. Or no, she asked, "Can you go pick up my car?" And I said, "The only way I'm gonna get you're gonna have your car back is if it's gonna be on cinder blocks, because that meant I stole all of your tires."
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Art. Art with us from Sacramento in California.
Hi. I related an experience where I was at a Christmas get together with my sister-in-laws, my brothers, and I was talking about race issues. And one of the things that I brought up was how, as a child, a Mexican American home, my mom, fresh, new from Mexico, kind of taught us keep your mouth shut around the white people, because there was a power difference, a pretty profound power difference, it was always that fear in our home, at least I remember growing up, is just you'd be very circumspect about what you say when you're around.
And that was as a kid. Do you think things have changed?
Yes. It affected. It's affected me now. As in my professional life, I have difficulties, issues around trusting. Who I can trust, and in that get together in Christmas last year, I brought it up to my Caucasian sister-in-laws about this issue of trust, and one of them kind of looked at me askew, you know, obviously shocked by it, because I've known her since we were kids. I mean, we grew up in the same neighborhood, same town, same church, respected our elders who happened to be Caucasian, but there was this underlying thing in my home, this just be careful what you say.
Be careful what you say. Gustavo Moreno, does that go on today, do you think?
I grew up from a different generation. Where I grew up, almost everybody was Mexican. In fact, the minorities were white people, and we weren't afraid of them. To us, they were just kids that we poked around and always called güero, which is whitey, and they didn't have a problem with it as well. It wasn't until college, really, when I was finally in an environment where I was the minority, and I think because I grew up so comfortable with my Mexicanidad, with my Mexicanness, I didn't have so much of a problem relating to people of other races or ethnicity once I went into college, and to this day. So I don't really see it as much of a problem.
Art, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Where do we go from here on this, do you think, Gustavo?
I think we should always be up front. We shouldn't be afraid. Art made a great point, and there are a lot of people who are afraid of talking about race. There are a lot of people who, because of the way they grew up, they fear the other. They fear the other races, whether they be African American, Asian, white, or Hispanic. And we shouldn't have that. The only way to get over that fear is really to talk to people about themselves and really celebrate the similarities. And I know that sounds very PC, hippy-dippy, but I always used a great example from the John Sayles film Matawan, 1983 or so forth, where you had blacks, you had Italian immigrants who didn't speak any English whatsoever. Then you had working-class West Virginia coal miners. Well, all those three groups, they were fighting amongst each other to try to get work in the coal mines. But what united them ultimately was a game of baseball. And that was something that was from there. They were able to go on and live a happy life. And they ended up breaking the strike, but that's a whole other story. But that's really the best way to do it, is just have a dialogue, be upfront. If you do have problems with people, we'll tell them. If you're polite about telling people why, the problem you have with them, then it's going to be much better than harboring all these bad sentiments within yourself.
Gustavo Arellano, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Gustavo Arellano writes the Ask a Mexican column for the Orange County Weekly. He wrote a book called Ask a Mexican. With us today from member station KPCC in Pasadena. Tomorrow at Science Friday, Ira Flatow will be here. We'll see you again on Monday. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News.